This call is being recorded.
How sweet it would be to find that I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know how it feels to be free. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know. All the love that's in my heart. Wish I could break all the things that bind us apart. Wish you could know what it means to be me. And you'd see, you'd agree, everybody should be free. 'Cause if we ain't, we're murderous. Like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be. I could find that I could fly. Soar to the sun. Look down and see that I know. Yes, I know. Oh, yeah. It's moving now. I know, got news for you, I already know. Jonathan Livingston Seagull ain't got nothing on me. Found out.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
We're poor, Ashe.
Ashe.
We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren and their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves, became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Muhammad,
John Henry Clark, John
Dr. Khaled
Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
And I'm going to say this and I'm going to end mine. If you ain't down for the Africans here in the United States, period, point blank, if you ain't down for the ones that suffered in South Africa from apartheid and shit, damn it, you need to step your punk ass to the side and let us brothers and us Africans step in and start putting some fun.
Negro ran out and attacked the rappers. Let me put the bullet on hold for a moment. Went out and attacked the rappers. He didn't know Tupac Shakur. You don't know Snoop Doggy Dogg. You don't know Biggie Smalls. You don't know Sean Puffy Combs. You don't know them butts. While you sitting on your butt, afraid to come into the community and deal with the grassroots of your people, a whole generation has come up around you. Let's talk about the rappers for a minute. Can we talk about the rappers for a moment? Let's talk about Tupac Shakur for a moment. Tupac Shakur is a child of the 60s. Tupac Shakur, born out of the spirit of the revolution of the 60s. Tupac Shakur, fire in his bones. Huh? Boldness and rebellion in his blood. Born from his beautiful, bold Black Panther mama, Afeni. Sitting in the jail cell, a revolutionary woman carrying the fruit of life, mocking the child in her womb, mocking the child with rebellion, mocking the child with insurrection, mocking the child with a spirit to not go along with what's been going on. When you got a generation like that, you've got to work with them. You got to mold them and shape them and fashion them. They represent the best generation we've ever produced. They're mad. They're angry. White man say, where your cap turn this way, they turn theirs around. He say he wearing his pants up, they wear theirs down. Whatever he says do, they do the opposite. Rebellious. Sick and tired of what's been going on in the hells of North America. And so they rap lyrics that speak to the pain and the suffering and the low-down life of the black man and woman. They speak to our condition at the grassroots level, in the muck, in the mire, and in the mud. Not to just be attacked. If you sit and if you stand in the pulpit that Adam Clayton Powell Jr. stood in, Adam Clayton Powell characterized himself in his words as the baddest nigga in Congress. The baddest nigga in Congress. That's what he said. He said, keep the faith, baby. Don't panic. Tupac said the same thing. Keep your head up. Keep your head up. But for butts and a few other butt-licking, boot-licking, buck-dancing niggas, somebody has to call these niggas out. But some of you are so connected to them, or you want something from them, or you want favor from them, or you want to be recognized by them. If you don't stand up for the liberation of our people, then to hell with any nigga. I don't care who he is or where he is, to hell with him if he won't stand up for the liberation of our people. If we touch the hearts and minds of the rappers, they could create a revolution overnight. Overnight. Literally, overnight. But to attack them and put them down, talking about the language that they use, when you're acting like what they're talking about. But to the youth who are under the sound of my voice, you too have a responsibility. You do have a responsibility to wake up, clean up, and stand up. And give liberation lyrics to our people that will uplift them and not degrade them and put them down. Because if we follow the same filth of the white man's world, then our world will go down under the weight of filth and corruption, the same way the white man's world is going down. And so to our young brothers and sisters, don't try to pattern your life. You're criticizing the butts and the other toms. But at the same time, you're trying to be like the Italian gangsters. You gangster rap. You dress like Al Capone. You dress like some other cracker, some Jew gangster, some Italian gangster. You're not a gangster. You are the very people of God, trying to look like some damn criminal from Italy, some mafioso, some Italiano boy. Look like fools on TV, dressed up in all of this mess. You diss black designers. You don't want to wear the clothes from your black designer. You wearing Tommy Hill, nigga. You wearing polo, because you've been so damn poor and you've been living so damn low until you don't want to do nothing to pick yourself up and do something for yourself and give proper direction and guidance to the masses of your people who yearn to breathe free. This is the year of the bullet or the bullet.
And greetings, my brothers and sisters. So happy to be with you here today. Hotep to all of you. This is the Black Reality Think Tank, and I am your host, Dr. William Rogers. As always, I appreciate your patronage and joining us here on our program tonight, where we're going to talk about one of the great giants of our time, Dr. Carter G. Whitson. And I just want to mention as well, last week we were going to discuss a subject matter that we unfortunately, due to some technical difficulties, we were unable to do that. And we are going to still have that discussion. We want to talk about that group of folk that call themselves the Negroes, the Negrocracy of America. What is that all about? Who is that? And we're going to be dealing with that on next week. But tonight we want to talk about a giant of a man. We were discussing the fact in our early part of this month that we were coming upon what was known as the celebration of African Liberation Month, which is formally gets its part from Negro History Week. But as we know, and as all of you know who listen to the Black Reality Think Tank, our efforts are African American history as a 365-day event. So what we want to do is use this as a time to highlight the work of the great legend, Dr. Carter G. Whitson. And so our program tonight is to sort of hone in on some of his work, his vision, his legacy, what he left us, and what was the meaning behind why did he feel he needed to do this? Why did he give up his life and surrender to this? You know, Dr. Whitson, with his brilliance, could have made a lot of money in his years. And he could have done some great things, but he chose not to, and he chose to work with his people. And so we want to highlight him tonight. And so that is our discussion. As you know, we are here every Tuesday night right here on the Time for an Awakening Network, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And so we're happy to do so. Our format is a call-in format. If any of you who are listening via the Internet would care to call us and ask a question or provide your opinion, you can do so at area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And the main purpose of our video is to wake things up, to wake people up, to wake our people up, to support the caregivers of our community who are trying to make a difference, and to sort of help them. Thanks so much, Brother Khalid Muhammad, for those remarks that he gave right after we spoke, as he talked about people that are out doing the grassroots folks who are trying to do that grassroots work and raise up the consciousness of our people, who will resurrect the mind of our people. That's a task. That is our goal. That is our objective, to do so. It's not an easy one. It's not going to be done overnight. It may not be even done in a generation. It has to be a continuing, ongoing thing. Just like the legacy that Carter Whitson, the great Honorable Marcus Garvey, left us, Malcolm X, so many of those other great minds who knew that they may not see that in their lifetime, but they needed to do the work anyway so that they could raise up the consciousness of our people. And that we must all participate in that. You can't do it from the sidelines. And as Gil Scott-Heron said, it won't be televised. You're going to have to get out into the street and make it happen. Our young people are needing us to do that. I am seeing and hearing some very horrible stories of last week and so forth, domestic violence at its highest level. And we've been talking about that here on the Black Reality Think Tank. We've had domestic violence experts on to do that, and but it continues, and it's going to continue to continue until we really get out and give people an alternative to get involved. We get into understanding the root of the problem so that we can go and solve that. Give those caregivers and those of us out there support as they try to make those changes. And there are a lot of people working out there. There are a lot of people out there trying to do something, but they need our support. It's not easy. You're not going to get those who are adversaries to help you. That's not going to happen. They're not going to teach you your history. They're not going to teach you the solutions to your community. That's not a part of their programming. Their program is to keep you where you are so that they can continue to control the money and the resources. So I'm asking all of us and those of you in our audience who are listening tonight, take that in strong consideration and use that as a launching pad for this African Liberation Month that we have to get out there. And even if you, just like I said, can't do it, you can support those that are doing it. By all means, please do that. And I say that. And I think that will embrace a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight and the late Carter G. Woodson. So we have our audience that is here with us. Our program, as I said, is part of the Time for an Awakening Network, which is part of Black Talk Radio Network. The Black Reality Think Tank is sponsored by Motherland Media, which also produces another program on this network called Africa Perspectives with Brother Oshiemi Adelapu. And also, the Black Reality Think Tank is basically sponsored and produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. And we've now been doing this for, I think, about 5-6 years. So we're pleased, and we hope that we can continue. We need your support, and we look forward to you passing the word on to others. You can go to our Facebook page, which is called the Black Reality Think Tank, and look at some of our past programs, some of the ideologies behind the things that we talk about here. And just embrace it, and you make suggestions, critique it. It's okay. You know, we want you to be able to do that. And so really, we really appreciate it. So tonight we're going to get right into our discussion. And as you know, we always do an ancestral profile. Well, the ancestral profile tonight is obviously Carter G. Woodson. So we want to talk about him. And he's not new to our discussion. We have often spoke of him before in many ways. But tonight I kind of just want to get a intricate look into purpose. And what was driving Carter Woodson to move forward, and his awareness, and how he was going to be able to do that, and what he was going to use as tools to make some of the changes that he did, and just look at his geniusness, and use this as a possibility of suggestions for us on things that we can do right now in our community. Because let me say, brothers and sisters, the time that Carter Woodson lived in and the conditions of the people at the time has not changed in 2020. You would want to think that it has, but it has not. The conditioning is still the same. His landmark work, as you all know, was the miseducation of the Negro. Well, black folk are still being miseducated in all kinds of ways. And so some progress has been made. We do have more folk on the battlefield who are trying to make some changes. And we, like I said, we got to support them. You're probably a little bit more than he had. And I think that's probably the one big difference between then and now, is you got more folk out there. You got some folk that have had some formal training that can do that. So very clearly, but in terms of the bottom line conditioning of our people, it's really still the same. Still poverty, still economic stratification, still social conditioning, still mental slavery. All of those things are still at work, and we see that all around us. And I don't like to be a doom and gloom guy, but we have to call the truth. We have to call it out like it is. Like my good brother, Dr. Khalid Muhammad, just said a few minutes ago, you had to call it out. Call them out. And if it's people who are blocking you from doing it and they're your own people, call them out. Because they are then become enemies of the people. You either work with your people for salvation or you're an enemy to your people. And that includes do-nothings. You may say, well, I just don't do nothing. Well, a do-nothing is an enemy to our people. And so we want to do that. Carter G. Woodson was a dynamic scholar. He was often called the father of black history. And being the father of black history, he didn't necessarily envision a different history for each race and ethnicity. He just simply felt that we had been omitted from the history of the world. So instead, what Dr. Carter Woodson saw was a missing piece of the puzzle of humankind. And we had not told our story. So we want to be clear. He's not talking about telling history that's different. He's talking about the missing parts of history. We were omitted. There are two kinds of crime when it comes to history, omission and commission. He's talking about being omitted from history. And he worried that the artifacts and the evidence of African people and American culture would disappear if they weren't preserved. So he put some effort together to try to preserve those things that he felt was missing. Washington believed that there was just one history, not a separate history for blacks and whites and Asians, but one history. And the biographer of one of Woodson's works about him is Carter G. Woodson, History of the Black Press and Public Relations. And he talked about that recent book written in 2017. And the author of that book said Woodson went about correcting the record, and many of us believe that it remains still to be corrected. Woodson got the world to confront the issue. And that's the reason why I think we need to honor him. Dr. Woodson was born December 19th, 1875, in New Canton, Virginia. He transitioned to the ancestral world April the 30th, 1950, at the age of 74 in Washington, D.C. In 1896, he received his high school diploma from Douglas High School in Huntington, West Virginia. In 1903, he received a Bachelor of Literature degree from Berea College in Berea, Kentucky. In 1908, he received his second bachelor's degree. And then he received his master's in European education at the University of Chicago. In 1912, Dr. Woodson received a doctorate in history from Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He has held positions as an author, an educator, and a historian. In 1903 to 1907, he was a teacher and school supervisor in the Philippines. In 1909 to 1919, he was a teacher in Washington, D.C. high schools. In 1915, he became the co-founder of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, now known as the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. He was the full-time director from 1922 to 1950. In 1960, Dr. Woodson became the founder and started a publication called the Journal of Negro History for Academicians. It is now called the Journal of African American History. This is a research peer journal for historians to write their research efforts and things that they were working on that we didn't know about and put in that. You don't know how valuable that is. And that journal is still available. If any of you are going to do any kind of research anywhere about African people in America, the Journal of African American History, formerly the Journal of Negro History, you must look at that. You must. In 1919 to 1920, he became the Dean of Arts and Sciences and a history professor. He was the head of the history graduate program at Howard University in Washington, D.C. In 1920 to 1922, he became the professor at the West Virginia Collegiate Institute, now called West Virginia State University, in West Virginia. In 1926, he became associated to become the founder of Negro History Week. Now, it's called Black History Month. In 1937, he was the founder of the Negro History Bulletin for Teachers, now called the Black History Bulletin. Because if you're going to educate our people, you have to prepare the teachers. And so you have to give them resources and material and be able to guide them. And that was Woodson's vision. He understood that the whole academic system had to be touched. You got to provide material. You got to provide a structure for teachers. You got to provide a structure for parents. You got to provide a structure for the researchers, and all of those that would move so. I just want to make one other point. Dr. Woodson's doctoral degree from Harvard was the first for a son of a formerly enslaved parent and the second for a black man. He was the second person to receive a PhD from Harvard. So as we indicated, Dr. Woodson saw the fact that history was a missing history. Woodson came late to the calling, in a sense, that would consume his whole life, his whole adult life was consumed in the history of his people. He was born poor during the Reconstruction period in rural Virginia. He was one of nine children of formerly enslaved parents who were skilled workers, but they were uneducated in the terms of the traditional American system of education. First, he had to help raise crops to feed his family, going to school only when the weather was bad. Then his family moved to West Virginia, where Woodson earned money as a coal miner. And then only at age 20 was he able to start high school. And as he advanced in his collegiate studies through two bachelor's degrees, a master's, and a doctorate, he saw that blacks classified as Negroes in the 1900 census were not included in the history books. So Woodson began to worry that black culture was going to be ignored or misrepresented. That still is a concern today. There's a lot of things that are going on in our community. People are not writing about it. They're not videotaping and doing whatever means is necessary. I know you got a lot of Facebook junk and all that stuff and Twitter and all that, but that's not the same thing. That's not going to hold as solid documentation for the study and teaching of our people. There needs to be more. In 1915, a couple of weeks after Chicago's celebration of the 50th anniversary of abolition of slavery, Woodson and four colleagues founded an organization called the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. This was later headquartered in his own Victorian townhouse in the District of Columbia's area called Shaw Neighborhood. It was a little more than a decade later, in 1926, Woodson had the idea of combining two birthdays already widely celebrated among black Americans. One was February 12th for President Abraham Lincoln and February 14th for the abolitionist Frederick Douglass into Negro History. And so a history professor at Howard University wrote extensively about this idea and what the Association of the Study of African American Life and History really meant. He called Woodson's a public relations genius. Woodson was very clever, the author said. He built up on two pre-existing celebrations. Black Americans had been celebrating Lincoln's birthday since his assassination, mostly with the Republican Party. And then when Douglass died in 1895, his birthday became an event. Then it goes transferred into a week, and Woodson changed the script. Now, you must remember, we don't want to be guilty of what we call presentism. It was promoted among white intelligentsia that Lincoln was responsible for ending slavery, and as a result, he was called the Great Liberator. And the reason for that is because the only research that had been done about Lincoln had been done by Caucasians and whites. So that's all we had to look at. Now, today, in 2020, we know that that's a different narrative. That is not the case. But we have to give the credit where credit is due, that doing that research, that's all they had to work with. And then it would be later that people actually from the Association of the Study of African American History would discover that that was another Lincoln that was not revealed to the public. That was another side to that. And so even though Woodson may have used that as a celebratory a landmark, however, it would be later discovered and realized that that was just not real. Black activism in the late 1960s, starting with the black organization called the Black United Students at Kent State in Ohio, helped transform Woodson's week into a month. They were the ones that were behind pushing that. President Gerald Ford made the expansion official in 1976 with a presidential message in conjunction with the nation's bicentennial. In the early years of Negro History Week, Woodson got people talking about black men and women who contributed to human civilization by promoting the observance in black-owned newspapers and across the country. His organization helped unearth and document three stories while developing classroom materials so teachers could spread the new knowledge. And that's the way it has to be done. They had to develop, because teachers weren't trained to do that. They weren't taught black history, like they're not being taught today, black history. I recall working with a school here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it was a school that was set up and designed to teach African history. They had a curriculum supposedly to use to teach African American history. But the problem was is that a lot of the teachers had not been trained themselves. And so I had an opportunity to get a contract to go in on the evenings after school and teach them to those who wanted to learn. They could not force the teachers to take the course because of the teachers' union. So if the teacher volunteered to come and take the course, that's fine. They would get a certification. They could use it toward graduate work and so forth and so on. But it was strictly voluntary. And rightfully, let me say, there was a large number of teachers that wanted that, and they did come. There were times we had 20, 30 teachers. And this is after school. You know, they're tired now. They've been working with kids all day. But still, they knew the importance of doing that. Well, that's what Woodson did. He created material. And he does that, and the Association for the Study of African American Languages does that to this day. You can right now call the office of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History and order some black history material right now to use in a classroom. That can be done. That's the kind of vision that Dr. Woodson had. Dr. Woodson often said that those who have no record of what their forebears have accomplished lose the inspiration which comes from the teaching of biography and history. Woodson himself said, and I've said this, I've shared this with members of our Black Reality Think Tank previously, that I recall once we were in a meeting. There was an Association for the Study of African American Life and History chapter here in Milwaukee. And it was started by Reuben Harpole and a couple of other folk, and I was a part of the beginning of it. And we were in the Dr. Martin Luther King Library on Locust and 3rd, waiting to have a meeting. And we were just sitting there waiting for some of the other folk to come that was due to come. We were going to have a meeting of association because we were trying to push it forward in the schools. And this young kid, he had to be maybe 7, 8, walked into the room. And everybody said, hey, little brother, how you doing? Okay, good. What grade you in? He said 2nd, 3rd. I can't remember exactly which one it was. That was a poster on the wall of a lot of African Americans who had done things in Milwaukee. It was a poster that had been designed. It later became a billboard. But it was a powerful poster. And he went over there and he looked at the post and he just started staring at it. And one of the brothers that in the meeting said, you know any of those people? And he looked at it and he said, no. He said, hey, where's George Washington? And we said, where's who? He said, where's George Washington? Why his picture ain't up here? And at that point, we knew why we were in that room and we knew the work that we had to do. And sometimes the Creator does that. He sends us stuff to wake us up. And so this 7-year-old boy, even though all these black folks there, he wanted to know where was George Washington. And so our title of our meeting today was that day was, Where is George Washington? And so why we needed to explain why we needed to teach this history. Woodson never married, but was not always a serious academic. That young poet, Langston Hughes, described while working briefly for the Negro History Association in 1924. He wrote newspaper columns, he played tennis, and he loved Paris, where he had studied at the Sorbonne, and he attended the theater. It was said of Woodson, he traveled and held a lot of parties at his house. He was not just that sour nerd type guy, alone with the gaslight in his studies. He also knew how to enjoy himself. Woodson was determined to convince the general public to embrace the past, including dark chapters on slavery and segregation. He said, we need to talk about slavery. That's something that I believe in. I talk about slavery. You can't come to my class. I don't care what you say. You're going to have to listen to me talk about slavery. And I'm not just talking about in the plantation and picking cotton. I'm talking about in the holds of slave ships and what that was like. And I'm talking about the feces and urine that would be passed down to our ancestors who were packed in those ships like sardines. And that's what Woodson believed. He believed that we should talk about that history and make sure that others understood it and feel that pain a little bit. So the African-American experience would take its rightful place in history books. He Carl Woodson also said we should embrace not Negro history, but the Negro in history. Woodson said what we need is not a history of selected races or nations, but the history of the world void of national bias, race hate, and religious prejudice. Yet black history remains segregated, and it has not become integrated. People who wonder why we need a black history observation in the 21st century evidence that our African-American contributions are not fully appreciated. And there are people that question this. There are our own people question, well, what do you got to go into that? We had that every year. So what? They know little about the parts that blacks have played in human history. That's, a lot of that's still missing. And believe that the problems with the lack of recognition were resolved 50 years ago after the Civil Rights Movement. People still need to know a lot. There's a lot of history about history. I recall a couple of weeks ago we did a piece on Paul Robeson. And a lot of folk told me that they didn't know certain things about Paul Robeson. They didn't know he had was an activist. Well, they didn't teach Paul Robeson in the school, and we talked about why they didn't do that. As I said, in 1912, he became the second African-American to earn a PhD from Harvard. This achievement was even more extraordinary considering he had been denied access to publication until he moved to Huntington, West Virginia, when he was 19 years old. Recognizing the need for an accurate representation of the contributions of African-Americans, Dr. Woodson and his colleagues established the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, as we said, in 1915. It later became known as the Associated for the Study of African Life and History. And so, to ensure an outlet, now see, one of the big problems about writing black history back then, and really today too, is that it's hard to find someone that'll publish it. Nobody's going to publish it. Knopf, New York Times Books, and some of those big publishing houses are not really publishing black history, unless you're Henry Louis Gates or somebody of that caliber. They're not going to publish the stuff that we do. So Woodson recognizes that. And so what he did is he founded an organization called the Associated Publishers in 1922. He directed the operation of both the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History and that publishing agency from his house in Washington, D.C. So they published the Journal of Negro History. They published the Negro Bulletin themselves. He published all of the books that he wrote and some other books by African Americans that never would have gotten published by a white company. So throughout his life, Dr. Woodson worked to develop a philosophy built on inclusion, multiculturalism, and racial harmony. His home quickly became a cultural center and a focal point for the instance of the Harlem Renaissance period. It was a national movement of cultural enlightenment in the African-American community. It is well known and documented by looking at the Woodson papers and going through a lot of the Woodson papers that a lot of the world leaders of the black world used to come to Woodson's house. People like Elaine Locke, W.B. Du Bois, Mary Church Terrell, Mary McLeod Bethune, Arthur Alfonso Schomburg. And even in 1925, at that time, there was a struggling poet. And when we say struggling financially, he was able not being able to get his poetry printed and get out, that worked for Dr. Woodson by the name of Langston Hughes. And he worked with Dr. Woodson, assisting him with rapping and mailing books, answering the mail, reading proofs, and the general operation of the office. In 1926, Dr. Woodson established Negro History Week, as we said, during the second week in February. And one of the things I want to do later on in our program, I want to now go to our audience and see what they want to do. I want to talk a little bit about his papers and where they are and what they contain. Most of his papers are at the Smithsonian in Washington, and they offer some interesting insight into who he knew and who he talked to and who was becoming involved. He talked to the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. They exchanged many forms of communication. It may even be said, I understand at some point he may have had something to do with printing the paper, The Negro World. But there's another thing I want to do real quickly before I open up the lines. I want to just kind of mention a little bit some of the books that Dr. Woodson wrote. He wrote, obviously we know, the landmark work, The Miseducation of the Negro. If you haven't read that, my brothers and sisters, you need to read it. It's online. You can actually go online and download the book and read it. So you don't even have to buy it. You know, just go take a look at it. It's now public domain. But one of his major works that was printed by the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History is called A Century of Negro Migration. He talked about the movement of Africans from the South to the North and the West and how that was done and what were the theories behind that. He also wrote a book called The Education of the Negro Prior to 1861. The Education of the Negro. And these books are still available. He did this through the Associated Publishers. He also wrote a book called The History of the Negro Church. And he did this before a lot of the other folk that did it, obviously, because he wrote it and he published it in 1921. He wrote a book called The Negro in Our History. Again, getting a chance to highlight specific people that we didn't know about. He wrote a book called Free Negro Owners of Slaves in the United States in 1830, together with Absentee Ownership of Slaves in the United States in 1830. So he documented that a lot of Africans owned people in captivity. But he gets into more of the theory of it and who they were and why they were owning it. And a lot is a lot different than the Europeans that owned. Wrote another book, did another book called Free Negro Heads of Families in the United States in 1830, together with A Brief Treatment of the Free Negro, which is a whole nother study in what that means, free Negro. John Hope Franklin would write in his book, Slavery to Freedom, that they were quasi-free. He's right, but still, nevertheless, they did not have ownership papers on them by other people. He wrote a book called Preview of Negro Orators and Their Orations by the Associated Publishers. He wrote a book, this is an excellent one. I've read this several times. It's called The Mind of the Negro, as reflected in his letters written during the crisis between 1800 and 1860. And he examines what African people were thinking and feeling in terms of what the letters they wrote to people and the things that transferred. And a lot of historians have followed that trend and done that as well. And there are people who have tracked the prayers that Africans used to say in churches. There are written documents that talk about what those prayers were. And just to kind of look at the state of the mind, which is extremely important. And that will help him to be able to formulate the Miseducation of the Negro. He wrote another book called Negro Makers of History. He did that in 1928. He wrote one called African Myths and Folk Tales. Now, here he's going to Africa. Now, this was done in 28, but it recently was done, published again in 2009. But it's called African Myths and Folk Tales. And he was looking at some of the traditions that were brought from Africa to the New World. Wrote another book called The Rural Negro. And there's a whole body of understanding about Africans who were living in the rural areas of the world versus those that were in the more urban places. As I indicated, I think was last week or week before last, that he had a very important, and we used him as an ancestral profile, Dr. Lorenzo Green. Dr. Lorenzo Green worked, and he was Dr. Woodson's right-hand man in terms of pulling together material and writing and research. He and Dr. Woodson wrote a book called The Negro Wage Earner. The Negro Wage Earner. He wrote another book called The Negro Professional Man and the Community, with special emphasis on the physician and the lawyer, who were African-American. He did this in 1934. Dr. Woodson, along with another giant of a historian, Dr. Charles H. Wesley, wrote a book called The Story of the Negro Retold. The Story of the Negro Retold. He also wrote The African Background Outline, or Handbook for the Study of the Negro. So what he was doing was developing material that the community could use to study. One of the things that the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History did is they had chapters throughout the country. And these chapters would get together and organize study groups. And all of them would have study groups like on Saturday or Sunday, whatever the local chapter wanted to do. And they weren't necessarily all academics, PhDs, and all of that. These were folk, the grassroots, who read Dr. Woodson's work and were using it to study, do things. They were like community schools, which is something that I highly have been pushing for a very long time, and to pull together Saturday schools to work with our children. But that is what the Association for the Study of African American Life and History did. Those local chapters were actually study groups. They didn't just get together and meet and talk about mess. They talked about having dances and parties. They talked about history, and they would look at it. It's kind of like a book club, and they did that. And then at the end of the, in the summer of every year, they got together for a national convention, and all the clubs came together, and they would meet in a specific location, and they would read papers, recent research. People were there that with books and artifacts and materials that you could use to teach. I had the honor of going to several of those events. One of the most exciting ones I went to was in Charleston, South Carolina, and got a chance to really get introduced to some of the Southern Charleston history. It was very rich, and the association chapter that lived in Charleston, that was in Charleston, had provided us access to plantations, and looking at all kind of different things. That was a very exciting convention. But there have been others. They've had them in Washington. They've had them. They had one in Milwaukee. We had one in Milwaukee around 20, maybe 08. Brother Claiborne Benson, Wisconsin Black Historical Museum, was the organizer of that. And as a matter of fact, that chapter of the Association for the Study of Black American Life History is still housed at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society. So if anybody's interested in maybe wanting to go and reactivate it, just call Sister Jamila, and she will help do that. Then there's another book called African Heroes and Heroines. That was also done as well, too. By Dr. Woodson. And then the other one, and then I'm going to open up the lines and let's talk, was a book he wrote with Michael Darrell Scott, which is edited by him, called Carter G. Woodson's Appeal, taken off from the David Walker Appeal, but basically the appeal to study history and study your life, and a lot of quotes in there and things like that of that nature. So that's a little bit about Carter Woodson that we have, and I want to open up our lines and see what our guests might want to add in terms of their understanding of Woodson and his work, for those who wish to say something and understand how to do that. I'm going to first go over here to my brother, as always, my brother from Philadelphia. He's always very active. And Brother Timothy, his wonderful things he has to say about his studies. He's an ardent student of history. I've been studying a long time. He's very passionate person, and he's also very passionate about the Black Reality Think Tank, and we appreciate him so much. Brother Timothy, what you got to say about Carter G. Woodson?
Well, doctor, I'm going to say this to you, sir. Thanks first for playing at Cape on Collin. You know, Collin and I used to hang together, you know.
Oh, great, okay. Oh, wonderful.
Come to Philadelphia. And we've had some great times together. If you ever looked at Collin, if you ever been around Collin,
well, I have been in his person. Yeah, I didn't know him though. I didn't know him.
Yeah, but you know, he looked like an original Black. His skin, his attitude, his build, his swagger. He's the type of guy that his energy. He was special.
Mm-hmm.
He was special, but no doubt. And he could flip on you. He could be humble at one point, and in a minute,
mm-hmm.
he turned that humbleness into strength. I'll put it to you that way. He was sincere.
Okay.
He was he would take a bullet for Farrakhan. You know what I'm talking about?
Right.
Heart of a lot of heart. But that's good. But let's get the Dr. Carter G.
Carter Woods.
You know, that's right. A required book that was read was The Miseducation of the Negro in Temple Number 12.
Okay.
They talked about that. And Van Sertima's book, Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark. But Carter G, without a doubt. And when I talk about Carter G to people, and when I think about, I'm not taking anything from Carter G, but when I kind of think about Carter G, I think about Du Bois too, because they were just more than writers. Mm-hmm. They knew the mind of the African-American male and female.
Mm-hmm.
He was more, Carter G. Wilson was more than just a writer.
Oh, yeah,
he
oh, no doubt.
Psychology. See, and when you read The Miseducation of the Negro, he talks about if the African were to set up a stand and do business, and you have a foreigner from another country do business, he said, people would leave your stand to the foreigner. He showed you what you were up against in your community and how we were so brainwashed right. from ourselves. So he knew he had to bring ourselves back to our original self.
Mm-hmm.
So they understood better. I think those men back there understood better the psychology and makeup of the African today than we do today. I don't think we're trying to get to our original self. And you know, if you ever read the autobiography of the ex-colored man, well, those men were not trying to be X. They were trying to give us our history the way it was. How can you not appreciate that?
Right. That's right.
I listen to me. Anything I can get on Woodson, and you giving me more on Woodson, you know?
Right.
And you know, so I feel so comfortable in my home when I come here.
Great. I'm glad. I appreciate that. And that's what that's what we wanted to do. I mean, this is why we celebrate. That's why we are able to celebrate this month, because of the fact of his vision and what he was trying to do. And like I said, it was just more than telling us about great people and great men and women. It was about harnessing material, getting papers that a lot of these museums and libraries don't keep about us. You can't find a lot of books about African-Americans today in a lot of libraries. They are missing. Libraries have a way of discarding our stuff. I went into a library in Georgia, and I went to look for a book called 2,000 Seasons, and they didn't have it. And he went through the card catalog, and didn't have it anywhere. He said, that's probably been discarded. I said, I can't believe that. And even the librarian said, I can't either. You all need to have some meetings and talk about, you know, this archive system you got and how it's doing that. I mean, you can go throughout the country. Now, probably there are some other libraries. I know that the library over at the Atlanta University system, they had a little bit more African-American books. But a lot of those older books, like Harold Cruz's book, the one that he wrote, I got a blank, man. What's that Harold Cruz book? The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. I tried to find that
book.
I tried to find that in the library. Didn't have it.
You're right.
And so, you know, what Woodson was doing was getting that. Because I had a chance to go to his office once when the convention, the Associated for Study of African American Life Convention was in Washington. It was in D.C. And so I went because I wanted to buy some books that he had. I wanted to get that book on the Black Church and a couple of other things that he had in there. And the lady was saying that there was an archive downstairs. There's so many books that they don't know what they're going to do. And because at that point, the building was falling in decay, and the roof was leaking, and they were having all kind of problems, and they weren't being able to raise any money. And I remember at a couple of the conventions, they were talking about a special fund to fix up the Carter E. Woodson House and such and blah, blah, blah. You know how that goes. And I think who stepped in was some of the organizations, the federal government stepped in and they preserved the Woodson House as a national historical monument, which means that it didn't get funds to be fixed up. But that's a shame that we couldn't do that from the community.
Right.
That's a real problem. We couldn't do that on our own. And a lot of our folk, we can't do that on our own. There are a lot of people in, I mean, like, for instance, there's no reason nowhere in the world that there isn't a humongous museum in Philadelphia for Black history. Now, I know you got one. I don't know what the status of how big it is, but you know that they need that. There's many famous people that we've talked about on the Black Reality Think Tank that came out of Philadelphia. Now, the Schomburg clearly is an example. But guess what? The Schomburg was going into K2. And it was having some problems, and they was talking about having to close it down and so forth and so on. And it was only because the New York Public Library came forward and took it in as one of theirs projects. And so they put the funding in it and was able to save the Schomburg, intensely. And the Schomburg contains everything, a lot of stuff. The Spingarn at Howard University, same thing. The Spingarn is a powerful resource and think tank material around African life and African history that's critical. You know, and when I talk about critical, what I'm talking about, for instance, there are papers that we would need to look at, for instance, that would sort of give us an idea of what was the economic status of sharecroppers in Tupelo, Mississippi, and get documented papers that would talk about that history, that would look at documenting a lot of life in those rural areas of the Delta of Mississippi. Right. And I know that Mississippi Valley State University in Itabena has now a depository system that they're trying to catalog a lot of those records that of life in the Delta of Mississippi. See, we ain't got that history. You don't know what that's like. That's some ugly history. And a lot of it has been covered. Those plantations, we talked about that previously. Those plantations weren't always there. We don't have that information of what those plantations were like. Now, today, when you take a tour of a plantation, it's usually you taking the tour about the architect. Are they telling you that this wood came from France or this marble came from? It's not about the struggle of the people. You know, and we need that. We got to provide that whole history and how that's done.
Can I stop you for a minute, Doc? Can I stop you one minute?
Yeah, go ahead.
You don't mind, sir?
Uh-huh.
In Philadelphia, the library that we have to be connected to, in which I want to connect you, is Dr. Charles Blackson. Now, he has the special collection of the history of Philadelphia.
Okay. All
and,
right.
And now I want you to talk to his people who are running it now. And he is related to Still, William Still.
He's related to who? Say it again.
William Still.
Oh, William Still, the opera composer.
The Underground Railroad operator.
Okay.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So he has, all his lifetime,
okay,
collected things, a lot from Philadelphia and all up and down the United States.
Okay.
And abroad. But he has the best collection of African Americans, one of, in the country. And a lot of Asante students who work on their PhDs and degrees have to go to his collection in order to put their dissertations together.
Right. That's important. That's important for us. We don't have that. You can't get that kind of intricate information out of the University of North Carolina or out of University of Texas at Austin. You can't get that critical documents like that. To talk about that kind of history. Let me go over here, too. Okay, go down. I'm going to try to get somebody else on, but go right ahead.
Okay, you got it, sir.
Okay,
next.
All right.
You be the next person.
Okay, all right. Let me ask Atlanta, Georgia, 404-453. Any comments? Or just listening? Okay, just listening. Sister Ayan, how you doing tonight?
I'm okay. How are you, Dr. Rogers?
Okay. I hope you heard, I had changed up just a wee bit. We decided to go with this as opposed to that. We're going to do the other one next week because you had originally called me and asked me about that. But we're talking tonight about Carter G. Woodson.
I've been listening.
Yeah. Anything you want to add?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. This is actually perfect. This is divine. Brother Timothy, thanks for what you were sharing. and teach them. I'm in learning mode. Greetings to both my brothers.
Yes.
So, yes, Dr. Rogers, I've just been learning. I've just been learning. Great. And whenever you go into history, I go into student mode.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I said this is divine because last night I got on the internet and I was just, you know, surfing a little bit because I don't do a whole lot of that. But I came upon Dr. Greg Carr doing a lecture on Dr. Carter G. Woodson.
Oh, yeah. Because,
you know, you and I talked about something else.
Right.
So I was looking forward to the stuff that you were going to talk about, but I came upon a talk on Carter G. Woodson.
Excellent. Isn't that something?
Yes. So I'm listening to this thing, and I'm learning some things about who this man was and all that he did. And it was, you know, he did a thorough, very similar to what you taught, you know, what you were teaching just now. So I was so, you know, interested. It just really captured me. So I said, you know, let me see what else is here that I can, you know, that I can check out. And then a young brother named, I think his last name is Manzesi.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. He's a professor out of, I don't remember which university.
Okay.
Maybe Emory or something like that. But anyway, he was talking about the miseducation of black boys.
Mm-hmm.
And he started talking about some of Carter G. Woodson's, you know, stuff. As a matter of fact, he had written a book on Carter G. Woodson's The Miseducation of the Negro.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So both of the pieces that I saw was on this very topic. I said, this is, when I turned it on, I heard you talking, I said, oh, man, this is divine. It really is. Yeah. So what I want to say first and foremost is that what you were talking about, the Saturday schools, this knowledge has to get to the masses.
Yes.
It has to get. Because the average person has no knowledge of this stuff. I've been an activist for many years,
mm-hmm.
and it was only since I met you and heard, you know, some of what Professor Small said, you know, talked to me about in terms of the importance of history,
right.
That I began to really see the importance of history.
Right.
Because the average black person, African here, born here, you know, those that haven't gone through an educational system run from history because everything we see about us is slavery and bad and a this and a that, you
right,
know?
Right.
And all this wonderful stuff, most people, I can tell you, I have a large family. I can guarantee you that 95% of my family has no knowledge of African history,
mm-hmm.
black mm-hmm. history here, black inventors, Carter G. Woodson, all the various black psychologists and historians, they have no clue.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we've got to get this information to this knowledge, not just but knowledge, you know, in order to improve our sense of value.
Right.
That's what history does.
That's what it does.
It improves, it, you know, because we have not valued ourselves. That's why we hurt each other so badly. But the more I learn, the more I value and see how magnificent we are.
And that's what our children would gain, if our children know that they come from greatness.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said they come from greatness.
Yes. But see, we'll say, you know, abstract things like, oh, we come from kings and queens, you know, an ancient Kemet. But this is stuff we did right here, these great teachers,
that's
you know,
right.
right here.
Right. That's right.
Great builders right here. The other thing I was thinking is when I was reading about the ending of slavery and even during slavery, how, you know, we risked our lives,
mm-hmm.
even through Jim Crow, especially the beginning of Jim Crow, trying to get educated.
Right.
And how young people, from what I've read, the youth during and after slavery were hungry for education.
Yes. Yes.
You know, our young people probably can't even identify with the hunger because it feels like something that's forced on them because, of course, they can't identify with, you know, when you talk about George Washington, that's pitiful, but that's what they can identify with.
That's who they did, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So our young people can't identify with a hunger and a thirst for learning because of what's been forced on them, forced down their throats,
mm-hmm.
and the way it is forced down their throats, and by whom,
right.
you know. I was also listening to a sister, it might have been, I can't remember the name, so I won't try to remember. But a sister who was talking about how she it was Felicia Rashad.
Okay.
Uh-huh. She was talking about growing up during the Jim Crow era and how all her teachers were black. From elementary school through, she went to Howard, you know.
Right.
All of her teachers were black.
That's right.
All her community was black. Everything was black.
That's me too.
And they made sure that she was raised properly and got a proper education.
Right. That's exactly
you
right.
know, and made sure that she was taught properly.
Yeah.
And, you know, all her class and her, you know, everything that's beautiful about her, she got that from the black community.
Right. That's right. And that history is there. It's rich.
Mm-hmm.
I said that history is there. It's rich
if it's
told properly.
Well, I just want to say, I'll end with this. I've observed that black folk, we get caught, a little too caught up in the person, the messenger, like Carter G. Woodson and
right.
you know, all the fantastic messengers that we have. And we want to build monuments and whatnot. That's wonderful. But we still got to spread their message.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Woodson was about educating our people. I didn't know this until I saw this last night and heard you. That's all he was about.
Mm-hmm.
He committed his life to this.
His whole life to that.
So we gotta pass that message. We got to know him, but take the message and do what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And we get so caught up in the name and even Farrakhan and just all of the names do what they're doing.
Right, right.
So I'll end with that because I'm feeling pretty passionate about this.
No,
right
that's
now.
Good. That's good. I appreciate that because you're so right. And that is our purpose tonight, to talk about the depth of that history like that, and so that people can understand the fact that there's just more to it than the Harriet Tubman. That's not to take anything away from Harriet Tubman, not take anything away from Frederick Douglass. But it's more to our life than that. You know, there's a whole history, for instance, of midwifery among African women on those plantations and those work camps of the South. I was just reading an article on that the other day about what they were doing, and they were bringing babies into the world safer because a lot of the white hospitals that were been developed
mm-hmm.
for African people were killing those black babies.
Mm-hmm.
They just had a session, a conference here in Milwaukee about infant mortality rate in terms of in these hospitals. And the question came up, well, what happened to midwifery? Where, you know, people were delivering the babies, didn't have to go to the hospital. You know, it's not a major surgery system. And so, you know, talking about that and what happened. The culinary arts, you know, the cooking, and where the history of that comes from and how our ancestors brought that from Africa. They knew how to go out there in the backyard and pull up certain weeds and use
mm-hmm.
them for seasoning that tastes good. And,
mm-hmm.
and they fed us with that, you know. So you're right, Sister Ayana. I agree. No doubt about that. You know,
can I interject this? Because you talked about the midwifery. I'm hearing so much now about for several years about black women have suffering from postpartum depression.
Yes.
Now, I don't think that that's normal.
Okay.
I really don't. Our ancestors had babies in the field and kept on working. Not only fed their babies, but fed the savage, you know, owners' wives' babies,
mm-hmm.
you know, by breast.
Right.
Breastfed, rather, you know, and still loved us. So something's wrong with that picture
right.
of young women now suffering from postpartum depression to the point where they want to kill the babies and kill themselves. And, you know, it's deep.
Yep.
So far, I've not seen that in our history. Black women having babies.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. And thank God for Toni Morrison, even though it was a piece of fiction, in Beloved, she stressed a lot of that in Beloved. Like, for instance, I really did not know that there was this thing that white men wanted to steal the milk of black mothers. They used to like to suck the breasts of black women and suck the milk out of them. And Toni Morrison brought that in her book, Beloved, where she was saying they're trying to steal my baby's milk.
Wow.
And that was, I had to look that. I said, dang, I never heard of no mess like that. you know, but it was true. There was something going on about that. There was some mythology about a black woman's milk was like pure or something, you know, which it probably was. But anyway, the men would, not only just in terms of rape, they would suck her breasts to get their milk, particularly among pregnant women. That's a horror piece that I had heard nothing about. So yeah, stay with me, brother, sister Jan. I'm gonna get a couple more folk here. I see a young lady that's online. I think I know what this is. She may have been invited by one of my brothers, and I don't have a number for her, so I can't call out your number. I see the last name Kingsley. I don't know, young lady, if you'd like to say something. I think I know who you are.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rogers.
Yes.
Is Pam Lawrence. And yes, I was invited by Alfonso Watkins.
Yep, I thought so. Because I saw your picture earlier. He showed it to me when he was talking about you, that you're going to be one of our guests tomorrow at our meeting. So that's great. Anything you want to say on this subject? Please do so.
Well, thank you first and foremost for having the conversation.
Yes.
And as you were all talking about medical things that happen to women, it just brought to me. I was studying on hysterectomies because that is one of the biggest things that happens to women, which is just a form of castration. Mm. And these doctors tell you that you have to have such a procedure. But later in life, there is some difficulties that you will be facing, and they never tell you about that.
Mm.
And so it becomes something similar to a hysteria. And so there is a group of women out of Washington, D.C. that have been lobbying to ensure that doctors have to, share with us different things that can be, considered, so that it's not just, having a hysterectomy. And what happens is when that removal of the ovary, it creates an imbalance. And how I know this is because I've actually endured this for the last several years as a business owner, and finding myself confused, or you don't know, it just creates an imbalance in the body and your equilibrium is off. And so when I researched exactly how these doctors had an opportunity to do this, and it was just a medical business move on their behalf, you find that Milwaukee had the highest numbers of hysterectomies done on African-American women right here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at Sinai Samaritan. So I began to look a little bit more closely to see what happens and what other procedures they could have done instead of just doing a full hysterectomy on these women. And so I think that is something that people need to begin to talk about. I actually write the articles in my magazine where you see,
wonderful,
I think it was somewhere around 170,000 hysterectomies in the country in just the last past year or so. This is not this is all by design. I just say that? And so at the end of the day, I think that is a conversation that women need to know, that doctors are not God. And when you walk in his office, it says practice in medicine. It never said that he was omnipotent and all knowing. So we have to start to research and look into things for ourselves.
Right.
We have to start to understand and not understand and take somebody else's advice on what should happen with our body, because innately this is a self-healing mechanism. And so I think that a lot of times we have dumbed down our own, we've dumbed down ourselves. Because we don't want to know, you don't want to look at it, and we just want to talk about the happy-go-lucky things and upgrade our cell phones. But at the end of the day, I think that if you really are about awakening, it's about upgrading your mind. It's about upgrading for your children, so that we can create a way that we can cut off this generational curse of welfare and all these other things that come from being traumatized for the last 400 years in America. So that's what I would like to say. Thank you.
You know what? I'm so happy you brought that up, because the medical field has really been an enemy to African people in this country ever since we've been here. It has been a serious enemy. And like I said, those infant mortality rates are not just there by accident. These were really situations that, and like you said, as you talk about the hysterectomy system, I mean, I've heard some things about that. They experimented a lot on African women in captivity. There's a large history of that. They were amazed at the African woman's anatomy, and they wanted to attempt to try to understand how it was made, because their idea, from what I read, is that the African was a direct link from the orangutan, and that the orangutan, and looking at the African woman's hips, and looking at the orangutan, would give an idea and support the belief that this is simply a connection from the gorilla family, from the ape family. And they experimented on women. They used their bodies, and they dissected all kinds of horrible stories. And a lot of that is still available. You just got to do key research. You got to be keen about the research. But there is some evidence that very clearly that this was done. And you're right about that. I'm so glad you brought that up. Let me ask one other question. I don't know if you have any information about that. What about Caesareans? I heard some stuff not too long ago about that's also a system. A lot of black women were told to get Caesarean births, and it created some major problems, and that's not always necessary to do. Do you have any information on that, I know you've been reading some things along those lines?
No, I have not looked into Caesareans, but I definitely will take a look. No, I did not, sir.
Okay. What about you, Sister Yon? Have you ever read anything about the Caesarean medical process and how that was used in another manipulative way?
I just recently read something about it, and I tell you, I'm getting older and I'm forgetting stuff, because there was something really, really sinister that I read about it. I can't remember what the one thing was, but a part of what I do remember is that they were taking the placenta. They were taking it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, stealing it and from the women without them knowing it and doing something with it, but something sinister. But, yeah, and I know that they're telling black women especially that they need Caesareans when they don't.
Okay.
When they actually don't need them.
That's what I heard.
And the other thing is that they are experimenting on us all the time. But Doc, I know you at some point you probably mentioned Medical Apartheid, that book. But they've experimented on us and still continue to do so from the very beginning.
Right.
They're experimenting on our brothers that are mass incarcerated, experimenting on with drugs. Different types of drugs. They are, they're just doing all kinds of awful stuff. Vaccines, you know, is causing people to become paralyzed, specifically targeted to black men and black boys, rather.
Right, right.
So, they're on it. They're about annihilation of the African. I really want us to be clear about that.
Exactly. Thank you. You are listening.
Hey, Doc. Can I say something?
Just hold on 1 second. Let me do this right quick, and I'll come right back to you. This is the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 to 9 Central Time, 6 to 8 Mountain, and 5 to 7 Pacific. And this is a part of the Time for the Awakening Radio Network, which is a part of Black Talk Radio Network. And we are here. The sponsor is Motherland Media, and this program is produced and directed by the Sankofa Historical Society. There are other programs I just want to mention real quickly. There's a program that comes on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 to 1 p.m. Eastern Time called African Perspective. And that program is produced by Brother Oshiemi Adelabu. And I just want to mention the fact that he's got a very exciting program coming on Wednesday, tomorrow. He has Dr. Bayina Bello, who is the author of a book called She Rose of the Haitian Revolution, and which was a part of the Hidden Colors video discussion. He'll be on tomorrow from 11 to 1, I highly suggest. And then again on Friday, because he's on both Monday and Friday, they're going to discuss the Netflix documentary, Who Killed Malcolm X? which is at the 55th year of the assassination. That will be on Friday from 11 to 1 p.m., and I'm sure that is going to be a dynamic discussion. And it's the guest is going to be Muhammad Abdullah, who has some information about that video and what it's all about. So I encourage you to do that every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And then on Monday and Wednesday, Brother Franklin Jones has a program called Black People Matrix. It's also on the Time for Awakening Network, and you can simply go to the streaming site, www.timeforanawakening.com, www.timeforanawakening.com. Or if you like, you can call and listen via telephone, area code 215-490-9832. And then on Fridays from 8 to 10, you have Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And that's Eastern time. And then again on Sunday, they come on from 7 to 10. And they always have very stimulating and exciting guests that they interview. Next week, the Time for an Awakening, the Black Reality Think Tank, is going to talk about the Negrocracy and the whole middle class status and what it was supposed to do and what happened. There's a large body of literature that talks about that Negrocracy thing and how it has divided our community with each other. And we're going to be taking off on our discussion. We're going to be looking at Alain Locke's book, The New Negro, that he wrote back in the 1920s. That's recently a work that's done on the life of Alain Locke, and talk about a little of that that whole idea. So, Brother Timothy, you had something to add?
Can you hear me, sir?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, good. Sister Yan, it is very pleasure to be with you, a part of this think tank here. And I'm going to say that, listen to me, I'm going to say this, that last week, Doc, you weren't on here, but me and Brother Pugh and another brother, we might have talked like you weren't here. And he said, one thing you started, you got all these minds together, and I love it.
That's
but
good.
Let me continue on. You talked about Greg Carr. Now, when I started graduate school in 1994, I would leave work. And I had classes on Mondays and Wednesdays. And I would leave work to put my papers together, but I would stop at the block collection, which Greg Carr, Dr. Greg Carr ran. And all the information I ever needed, Greg Carr would give me out of the Blossom collection. Now, definitely was Greg Carr. Now he's Dr. Greg Carr. And I'm laughing because him and I talk about our experiences, because I was working on my master's at the time. He was working on his master's MA PhD.
Okay.
And he's one of the smartest brothers that was ever on that campus that knew his history. And he got it from Bloxham.
Yeah.
My point is, once he got his PhD, he became department head at Howard University.
That's right.
And I don't know if he's still there.
Still is. Oh, yeah. He's still there. Yeah.
He is. Let me tell you something. He is a and you know what, Dr. Rogers, he was working on a book on Dr. Clark. He was the first person I ever said that wanted to work on a book and put his works together and talk about Clark. A lot of people don't know about Clark.
Right.
I don't know if he finished it, but I know he was working on it.
Yeah. You know,
I wish he would come on this program one day. He's a great guy.
I would love to have Dr. Carr here. Trust me. We do that libations that we do in the beginning of the program is Dr. Carr's libations. But we've got a lot of brilliant brothers and sisters out here who are very powerful minds and that we just don't, a lot of times don't know about because of the ability to get the word. But that's what we want to do here on the Black Tank Speak Think. We got to spread the word. And Sister Kingsley, I'm so glad you were here because I'm going to trust me, I'm going to be tapping into you some more, Brother Alfonso, and I already talked about that. So we get ready.
Hey, one more thing I want to say, Doc, if you don't mind.
Let me finish. Let me finish, brother. You can come. And Sister Kingsley, I'm going to be calling on you so you can get ready, okay? Sister Kingsley, are you still there? Okay, maybe not. Okay, Brother Timothy, what you said?
I'm going to say one more thing. I'm not going to take up too much space. But you were talking about the milk from the African woman.
Yeah.
I read an article just today on George Washington's slaves.
And he went around looking in the area. Remember, they have they talk about his teeth were made of tusks or some type of material. I found out in his article, guess where his teeth came from? His slaves.
Wow.
Yeah. They were taking out the of his slaves and putting them in his mouth.
I've heard those kind of stories. I've heard some of those things.
Oh, God, man. Yeah. They're horrible. They're horrible today. Yeah. They were horrible then. Yeah. They will be horrible in the future.
Yep, you're right about that. Brother Marcus, God. How you doing, Brother Marcus?
I'm great, good brother.
Okay, good. How you doing? Happy you're on.
I'm good, Dr. Rogers. I'm good, you know. My sister Ayan was talking there. You see, they use that placenta, you know, to make cosmetics. Yeah, a lot of white women use that placenta, whatever they did with that placenta, to rejuvenate their face. You know, they, you know, by a white woman, by the time she hits 30, 40, you know, she get a turkey neck, you know, and skin wrinkles.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah, that's what they use that placenta for. But one of the first books I read was that book, Carl G. Woodson's book, and it was an eye-opener. It, you know, really blew my mind to see really what these European people did to African people. But I'm still hopeful, I'm still optimistic, you know, because given what we have been through in this country, it's amazing we're still here talking on the phone. Really.
Right.
It's amazing we are here still, even because, you know, what what these people have done to us.
Yes.
So I am convinced that we are going to win this struggle, in spite of how dismal it looks. See? And we must always remember that we are in prison here in America.
That's
you know?
Right.
America
That's
is a prison right. for black people. You may be outside walking around, you know, you may not be in that physical prison, but right. the entire society is a prison.
Right.
Because the food we eat, the clothes we wear, the medical system he was talking about, the educational system, and the warden is the police. You see?
Right.
So, you know, we got to decide what we're going to do, you know.
Yes, yes.
When you're in prison, you have to know what to do. Okay, so, but I am convinced, and this, when you started the program, my brother, with Nina Simone and Brother Khalid, that was fire.
All
so
right.
I knew this lecture, this program series was going to be fire.
Thank you.
So
thank you.
Keep
thank
on.
You.
Blazing the fire, good brother. Thank
yes.
you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much, Brother Marcus. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. And that's, my brothers and sisters, that is what we really need, we're trying to do. We must raise our energy, our spirit to continue to fight. We're in for a hard battle. This is not easy. And there's an old saying that says that a lot of times battle fatigue makes cowards out of us all. Because sometimes you fight so hard, you get tired. And you don't want to even fight no more. You know, you get tired of fighting. But we can't give up this battle because of some of the things that I think we see in our world. For those of you who are not part of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is a very horrible story here that happened sometime last week, a young brother, I think he was in his late 20s, killed his baby's mother and killed the two children, too, in a domestic violence situation because she was going to, he felt she was going to leave him. And when you hear stories like that, you know that there's still work that we need to do. There's still children who have warped vision of life because they haven't had the foundation to present that. And as Sister Ayan said earlier, sometimes this history, sometimes this fire that's in this history can waken people up to take a look at themselves and realize that's not who they are. Brother Khalid, if you heard our introduction to the program, talked about the whole birth of Tupac Shakur. in the womb of a black revolutionary, womb of a powerful woman who understood the trials and tribulations of our people and who was a fighter. And yet she's sitting in a prison cell behind bars, nurturing that child. And he came out ready. He came out full of fire. And that womb and that whole concept of that womb is real. It really is. And we have to create some alternative wombs where we can begin to do that with our children. The Saturday schools, I keep saying it, the Saturday schools. We have to do that. And the reason is because it's a possibility that we can do it with a free hand. One of the things I wanted to do was look at Dr. Woodson's papers. You can go to the Smithsonian files, and actually it's online, and you can look at what papers have been collected, because I wanted to see who he was in touch with, because he built all this stuff on his own. He created a publishing company to publish the material that nobody else would do. Do you know how critical that is? And then he hired one of the giants of the literary world, Langston Hughes, to help him. And Dr. Lorenzo Green. They worked with him. Now, you know they ain't make no money. You know that. That wasn't about money. That was about passion and commitment to our people. Most of our brothers and sisters who worked those years died paupers. You know, they didn't have monies to do things with, you know, because they weren't a part of that larger system. But they still did them anyway. They found ways to be creative. There are ways that we can be creative. And the Association for the Study of Latin American Life History has done that. I've watched that. I've been to their convention. I've been a follower and an ardent member of the Association for the Study of Latin American Life History for over 25 years. I've watched what they do. They make money. They create these products, and then they offer them to teachers and schools to use and to teach their children things. And these are not just junk stuff. These are things built around themes. Like I think this year's theme is about voting, because obviously we are facing a crucial election. They wanted to make that aware of children and how to do that and how to create the passion for voting. If that's an answer, you know, I mean, some might say that's not even the answer. But still, a young person coming up to know needs to understand how that system works and so forth. And so that's what the Black History does. I don't know if my brother at area code 414-399 wants to say anything. If not, if you're just listening, that's fine. But I will.
Just listening, bye-bye.
You just listening?
Yeah, I'm just listening, Bob.
Okay, sounds good. All right. Okay, so we are definitely brother my Newport News brother Griffin. You want to say nothing? Because I know you've had your mic muted for a while, brother Griffin. I don't know whether you're available, but I guess no, you're just listening. That's okay, and that's fine. Let me try one more time. The Atlanta, Georgia number 404-453. Are you listening, or you want to say something? Okay. All right. That's good. Okay.
I want to say something, if I may.
Okay. No. Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
Okay. I'm sure many people are familiar with this prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I've been saying that prayer for myself a lot recently because I'm going through some challenges. And I started to take a look at the things that I actually can do. I can do a hell of a lot. Mm-hmm. I can do a hell of a lot. And I can do it without money. So the battle that you talked about when you were talking about battle fatigue, that is so real for us,
yep.
You know. But the battle is really for the mind. Now, no, we know that. We know that. But the battle is for the black mind. That's what we have to fight for, because when you have this small, relatively small numbers of conscious, woke people, revolutionaries, whatever we call ourselves, saying, you know, don't yourself get properly educated and, you know, all these things that we've learned over the years, you have a whole media run by the oppressor telling all our young brothers that they got to become millionaires.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And having our sisters eating like dogs, so that I went out today and half the black women I saw were obese, not just overweight, but obese.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're getting these messages from the oppressor that is so much louder than our voices.
Mm-hmm.
So the battle is for the mind, and we've got to make the final way to commit back to ourselves, because we can do a whole lot without money. You said it. I think you referenced it earlier.
Yes.
We can have Saturday schools or Sunday, any kind of night school, anything,
right,
and we don't need a whole lot of money. But when the system is telling you that you got to be a millionaire in order to build a certain type of institution, you won't get it. The average person is
right.
just going to forget about it.
Right.
But if we say, we can meet at so-and-so's house and start having studies,
That's
study
right.
groups, discussion groups. You know, this church,
That's how Winston did it.
This mosque, or wherever.
Yep.
We can do that. Getting back to the prayer, we can do that.
That's how Woodson did it.
Exactly, and so many others did it.
Uh-huh.
I was reading how teachers in the early 1900s, young people were teaching school that had third grade education, sixth grade education.
Right.
They were teaching us how to read and write, our ancestors.
Yes. Yes,
you know, in little coal buildings and whatnot, but they were committed. So we got to ask the question, what is actually preventing us from doing those very basic things that don't require all this money? Everybody's trying to get a 501c3. I'm in a community, in the activist community, and we claim we can't do things because we need all these things that we really don't.
Right.
So again, what is in our way? What is preventing us from doing basic things?
That's what I want to know.
But we need to have the discussion nationally, and I'm pushing for this, and I want to push for this more, to have a national discussion on why we're not doing the things that we can do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Quick thing, because I forgot this. In Winston-Salem, the city next to me, someone just told me last night that there's a little area near where my family grew up, that there are a whole community of slave cabins that are still standing.
And I can believe that. You know why? You know why? R.J. Reynolds. You know what R.J. Reynolds is?
Yeah, they employed everybody, have all the money, tobacco company. Mm-hmm.
The big tobacco giant. The big tobacco giant, you know, where black folk picking tobacco. And see, those tobacco plantations were like hundreds and hundreds of acres long. Philip Morris, sitting over there in Richmond, Virginia, is one of the hugest plantations on the planet Earth. Those tobacco fields were so far, you can't even see one end to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. That's right. You're right. And see, North Carolina, right there where you are, Greensboro, Durham. Durham is Liggett and Miles. Winston-Salem is R.J. Reynolds. Brown and Williamson.
They're all down here. The thing I wanted to talk about, mention with the cabins is that they've been sitting there for hundreds of years. They're still intact.
Hmm.
And the city actually were moving people into them, you know, with the calling it low-income housing.
Get out of here.
That's what I heard. Now, I got to confirm that, but I'm pretty sure that that's, you know, that's the truth. So now some members of the community, after finding out that these are actual slave cabins, they're trying to preserve them, and they're talking about moving them somewhere, you know. But this is history right here in Winston that my whole family grew up in.
Right.
And none of us knew. That's what I'm talking about, how much we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And there's a lot more. And unfortunately, a lot of these universities don't want to delve into that because a lot of them don't have the information. Some do. And when they do delve into them, they do it from another perspective. They do it from architect, or either they do it as as geologists, they digging up the dirt, things like that, which are good. I mean, because that does reveal some things. But those historians are real critical, because what they got to do, here's the deal with black historians. This is what the reason why they are important, is that they have to revamp that bad history that was written in the 18th, 19th, and 20th century. They got to revise that history, re-correct that, because that's some ugly stuff that was done. And so, like I said, there's two forms of bad history, omission and commission. And so in the commission history, because there's a lot of material that was written about how great slavery was, that it really wasn't bad, that it was really good history. And that, well, I don't know why people are balking about it, because that helped black folk. Slavery saved them. Slavery brought them out of heathen Africa and brought them here and civilized them. That's a whole, I'm talking tons of material. And not only just historical, they've turned it into fiction. They've turned it into music. You've heard that song, My Old Kentucky Home, where all the darkies roam. And that's still today played in the Kentucky Derby. When the Kentucky Derby runs this race in April, they will play that song. Now, what they say is, they say, my old Kentucky home where all the children roam. They've taken the darkies out. But the original song was Where All the Darkies Roam. And that is a song that talked about the moonlight, the magnolias of the South, the good old South, you know, and try that feel-good stuff. We got to go in there and tear that history up. That has to be torn up. You know, and that's what Du Bois wanted to do that. He wanted to write about the great African kingdoms, and they blocked it. The guy at Harvard said, no, we don't know about no great African kingdoms. So he had to change his dissertation to the suppression of the African slave trade. So that's the kind of thing that we've got to do that's not being done. Because here's why. These are the history books. If you right now today asked a fifth grader, could I see your history book? Could you let me see a copy of it? And I do that because I got grandkids. And I asked them, I said, can you do me a favor? Can you bring me? They said, well, history book? I ain't got no history book. We don't have history books. I said, what do you learn about stuff? They said, that's my social studies book. I said, okay. And they bring that, and it's got all kind of stuff mixed up in there. And it's twisted around. The Civil War was fought to end slavery. That's still in there. That's still in the history books. And so we've got some work to do. And we've got some truths to be told. And it's going to only be us to do it. Nobody's going to do that for us. Nobody. Brother Timothy, you want to say something? Brother Timothy, did you want to add something? I can't hear you, Brother Timothy.
Oh, wow. I cut it off.
Brother Timothy, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, sir. What were you saying?
Did you want to say something? Did you have something to say?
No, sir. I'm listening to everybody reminiscing on this good language and this good information. I'm listening.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry.
It's all good.
I thought you had something to say. But, yeah, and that's what Carter Woodson was doing. If you ever get a chance, just go and look at some of the back copies of the Journal of Negro History. And look at the ones that are called the Journal of Negro History. They eventually changed the name to the Journal of African History around the 80s. Morehouse College started printing the Journal of African American History. And when they did that, they changed the name of it. But you need to go back and look at some of the past issues of the Journal of Negro History, the stuff that they wrote about, the history that was there that you'll never find in a textbook. In the very first Journal of Negro History, I took a look at what the articles were and what Carter Woodson was writing about in the first journal. And one of the first things that he wrote about was the problem with the mulatto slave, with the mulatto captives, and what problems did that cause. And he wrote a staving history about that idea, about all of that, and looked at some of those kinds of things. Other things in the early ones were material on the black church at that time, the Negro church. And he was looking at, you know, some of the stuff that they were, you know, dealing with. And I'm talking about how they fed and clothed people, how it was used to start schools. A lot of schools started out of black churches. You know, Tuskegee started out of a church. And so, you know, and how all of that began and who was involved in it. And, you know, looking at sometimes there's something about the Quaker Philadelphia and what that whole Quaker thing was in terms of history. He wrote about that in the journal. And these were researchers who were researching material or what was available. And a lot of the early archives, most of that kind of story would have to be gotten from D.C., you know, out of the Smithsonian. Because a lot of those university archives, many of them were segregated, so blacks couldn't even go there, so you know they couldn't use the library. So that would have been a problem. So then where are they going to get the information from? Well, at that time, Howard and all of the black schools didn't have libraries like that. So they had to find creative ways to get those resources to even be able to talk about the history. You definitely couldn't go to the plantations and get it. You definitely couldn't get it from white historians. They're not going to share it with you. So that was a challenge. And that's why Carter Woodson is critical, because he made the open the door to be able to go and find and get that material. And that's why people like Arturo Schomburg was guided toward how to go about getting that, how to get that material. And he went throughout the world. He didn't just go to the country finding books on African history and African greatness. And I'm talking Africa and greatness. That was Arturo Schomburg. And he was backed by a lot of Carter Woodson stuff. I found some letters between Arturo Schomburg and Carter Woodson where they were discussing collections and where he should go in some of his travels to get some of that information from. And he did that. They would be able to go into special libraries like in Spain, France, that had all that stuff, and they would not be blocked from getting it because of the fact that it was not segregated, you know, at that particular point. So that would be a way for him to access that information as well. And then obviously the whole idea of writing and publishing it so that people could read it and see it. And who would read it and see it? And that was very clear in doing that. And so then there were some friends like Quakers and others that made access to certain materials and records. Brother Timothy, you had something to add? Okay. Because I keep hearing the background. That's why I thought it was you, Brother Timothy, wanted to say something.
I think he doesn't have his phone on mute.
Yeah, he doesn't. Yeah, so. And I thought he was trying to come in. So anyway, we're at that bewitching hour. Thank you so much, my brothers and sisters, for being here with us. We'll be back next week. We're going to talk about the Negroocracy and looking at it. Have a wonderful and productive week, and I will see you next Tuesday. Thank you.
ourselves. We're tired of beating our head against the wall and working with someone else.